So this afternoon I would like to really go back a little bit to the theme of compassion. Simply because compassion is so very central in the whole of this path and teaching. And, you know, in very real ways, the Buddha didn't kind of weigh one over the other. He really spoke about wisdom, insight, and compassion being equally significant, equally pivotal. And I wanted to start by reading to you what is called, that's one version of what is called the Bodhisattva vow, which is the commitment of compassion. And this vow says, though the many beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. Though greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly, I vow to end them. Though the Dharma is vast and fathomless, I vow to understand it. Though the Buddha's way is beyond attainment, I vow to embody it fully. This vow, is recited in countless temples and monasteries and by individuals on their cushion around the world, really on a daily basis, because it sets the intentionality of the path. And I think it really reaffirms in people's hearts and minds the essence of the meditative path. I want to give you a little bit of a history to how this vow arose. At some time around the first century AD in northern India, actually probably what is now Afghanistan, one of the most graceful and powerful texts in the Buddhist tradition was composed in Sanskrit. Some centuries later it came to be known as the Lotus Sutta. But the central theme of this text is the portrayal of a powerful and boundless compassion that is the embodiment of an awakened mind. A compassion, as it's described in this text, that pervades all corners of the universe, relieving anguish and pain and suffering wherever it touches. Now, in this text, it's really the first mention of this image of Avalokiteshvara. It's always such a mouthful to say that. But translated, it means one who listens to the sounds of the universe, or one who hears the cries of the world. Now, when this sutta was translated into Chinese around 400 AD, the name Kuan Yin began to emerge. And this is a figure some of you will be familiar with. If you've been to Gaia House, there's an image of Kuan Yin center stage. But it's often found in much Chinese art, this portrayal of this feminine presence, which is very much said to be the embodiment of compassion. Now, Kuan Yin has continued to occupy a very central place, particularly in Mahayana traditions, in this teaching and the practice ever since. Now, over the centuries, it's interesting that Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin, has really been portrayed in a wide variety of different ways. The most familiar way, or the most familiar image many of you will have seen, is as this very feminine presence with a face serene, a body very graceful, often sitting with her arms outstretched, with her eyes open, embodying this very receptive, warm, embracing presence. And she's usually shown as being seated on a lotus flower. And the lotus flower is a symbol of the deepening and opening, the flowering of the heart and mind. And Kuan Yin usually holds in one hand a book of suttas or discourses. which symbolizes her understanding of emptiness, of non-self. And on the other hand, she usually holds a vase, which symbolizes this bottomless pouring out of love and compassion. But over centuries, Kuan Yin has appeared in a whole lot of other forms. Sometimes Kuan Yin appears in a masculine form. In China, Kuan Yin is often portrayed as holding a willow branch. And the willow branch is the symbol of the compassion's capacity to bend in the most fierce storms of winds of life and yet not be broken, being able to spring back upright. And the weeping willow is often said to be synonymous with the Kuan Yin's compassionate care for the ills of the world. Avalokiteshvara, as you may have seen this image, is sometimes portrayed with 1,000 arms and hands, and in the center of each hand is an eye, which is the symbol of this constant awareness of suffering and distress, and this all-embracing compassion. Another portrayal, which I think is sometimes puzzling to people, is Kuan Yin is sometimes seen in the guise or depicted as an armed warrior, coming with a multiplicity of weapons, like some sort of medieval fighter, you know, with a crossbow and thunderbolt and spear and shield. But that symbol is really the embodiment of compassion's commitment to the protection of life and to uprooting the causes of anguish. Now, I think all of these different portrayals of Kuan Yin, or of compassion, actually, are not an invitation to create some sort of idealized and distant aspiration that's somehow projected into the future or seen as some kind of impossibility. But I think it's an invitation for us really to explore the different dimensions of compassion and what it really means to us in our own lives and in our own relationships and our own way of being in the world. I also think that in these different portrayals, there's the encouragement not to be dualistic in our understanding of compassion. Because I think many people are really quite drawn intuitively to this sort of, you know, this graceful, receptive, gentle presence. But it's important to see that compassion has this other side, with this kind of fierceness. It's this kind of fierceness of commitment to ending the causes of suffering. So compassion in these portrayals is both agency and receptivity. Both are very much two sides of the same coin. But what is central, as you heard in the Bodhisattva vow, what is central in this path of cultivating compassion is two things. One is the commitment to ending suffering and anguish in all its forms. But the other part, which is equally important, is the commitment to ending the causes of suffering in all their forms. And compassion, as it's very much taught in this tradition, really emerges out of wisdom. It emerges out of insight and could be in some ways said to be the embodiment of wisdom, the embodiment of insight, particularly the embodiment of understanding the emptiness of self. The emptiness of self is central to it. In the Diamond Sutta, it's said that any bodhisattva who undertakes the practice of meditation should treasure one thought only. Understanding perfect wisdom, I will vow to liberate all beings from the wheel of suffering. And yet when vast, unthinkable myriads of beings have been liberated, truly no being has been liberated. Why? Because no bodhisattva who is a true bodhisattva entertains such concepts as self or other. Now, I think this apparently paradoxical statement is really there to illustrate this very powerful marriage of both understanding emptiness and yet being fully present in the world of beings who really do suffer, where there is very real pain and anguish. Now, the classroom of the Bodhisattva is this life. You know, it's like Reb Anderson once said, you know, Buddhas don't live in the suburbs of suffering. They live downtown. It is, the classroom is this life. I mean, anyone, as in all the Brahma Viharas, can be compassionate from a distance when we're undisturbed. But true compassion, I think, is not forged at a distance. I think it's really forged in the fires of conflict and sorrow and pain. And Shantideva, I think, pointed to this. And Shantideva was one of the great teachers of compassion. He said, whatever you are doing, ask yourself, what is the state of my mind? With constant mindfulness and alertness, accomplish good. This is the practice of the Bodhisattva. So it is really saying that everything matters. Now, why did the Buddha emphasize compassion so much? Because there is sorrow. And at times in this life it seems bottomless. And to respond, we're asked to really be present, to understand its causes wherever it arises. And I think in this sense, compassion is not about saving others. It's not about rescuing others. It is about the real willingness to probe beneath the surface of pain and to bring to an end the causes of suffering. You know, as Milarepa, and I'm actually going to really use a lot of Mahayana teachings in this. As Milarepa once said, just as I instinctively reach out to care and heal for a wound in my leg as part of this body, why should I not reach out instinctively to heal and care for the wound in another wherever it exists as part of this body? There is a universality, I think, to the experience of grief and anger and rage and fear and frustration. And I think sometimes when we're in the midst of them, we can be so convinced that no one has ever felt like this before. Or no one has ever felt like we are feeling right now. And yet I think it's really true that there is no pain that we experience that has not been experienced before by another in another time or place. Now that does not lessen or diminish our own struggles or our own suffering. But I think more and more we do come to understand the possibility of the human heart to know both pain and joy. A friend of mine once told me about what she went through in the months after her child died. And, you know, she was, of course, completely devastated by this death. And yet she saw in many of her relationships how people seemed to reach a kind of compassion fatigue. You know, that so there was a time when it seemed that in other people's minds there was this expectation that now she should be moving on. And so she said she found herself responding to that by, you know, when people asked her how she was doing, she knew they didn't want to listen anymore. And she would say, you know, I'm coping, you know, I'm getting there. And yet underneath there was still this kind of burning fire of grief and anguish. And she told me about how remarkable it was for her when she actually went to a group for bereaved parents. And how she would sit in the group and one person after another would simply tell the story of their grief. Nobody was trying to fix anything. Nobody asked them to be different than what they were experiencing. Nobody had a timetable for recovery. But she said there was this simple, wholehearted listening. And she said that was the time when she could look into the eyes of another person and knew the universality of that pain and that grief. And she said for her, that was actually when the healing began. That was the compassion. Now there is so much pain in this life, which is actually, as I mentioned earlier, born of conditions outside of our control. And yet how much, when we look in the world around us and the schisms and the divisions and the fear and the mistrust and the violence, how much sorrow and pain in this life is really born of this very profound and unquestioned belief that we live as an independent self, separate from the rest of the universe. And in many ways, compassion really asks us to examine this belief, because we do really feel, we know, we not only feel that, we live often that sense of separation. Now, it's not surprising, and this is not at all to be judged, but it's not at all surprising that in that belief of in separation, one of our primary concerns is actually the survival of ourselves, the protection of ourselves, the enhancement of this isolated, separate self, because we do often feel to be one very vulnerable and fragile self in a world of many selves that we are at times competing with, who do not always feel benevolent, who have their own agendas about protecting and preserving their separate self-existence. In that separation, we actually don't always appreciate how our feeling of vulnerability is actually reflected in the myriad mirrors of the countless beings around us. As a Christian mystic once said, that anxiety is the mood of separation. That anxiety is the mood of isolation. And yet that anxiety can feel so difficult to embrace, and what we often do with anxiety, we get busy. You know, we try to camouflage often that underlying anxiety with busyness, with distractedness, with doing. It's almost as if we protect ourselves from a sadness that feels too much to bear. And then Pablo Neruda, he spoke to this, I think, so poignantly in his poem, Keeping Quiet. And he said, if we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might embrace the sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves alive. Now, as I also touched on yesterday, this gap between self and other is not neutral, because this is where hatred and anxiety and prejudice and fear live. And there's a kind of segregation, I think, that happens in this belief in separation. We can feel segregated from the rest of the world. My body, my history, my family, my wants, my needs, my fears, my likes, these we are all the territory of me and mine, separate from you and yours. Now, sometimes we're lucky, you know, and our views and opinions and our prejudices and our beliefs happen to harmonize with somebody else, and we have an us. But very often we're not so fortunate, and we can almost on a daily basis practice a kind of like segregation and apartheid, keeping ourselves close to us and away from them. Now, I think profound compassion is really dedicated to understanding and dissolving this almost invisible barrier that keeps us imprisoned and separate. I think we really need to sense that this sense of separation is actually not terminal. It's not a life sentence, because we have the freedom to question. We have the freedom to investigate. We have the freedom to begin to choose how we perceive ourselves and others. There are moments, I know, when all of us experience that falling away of separation. Moments of open-heartedness, moments when we look into the eyes of a homeless person and we see not their story, but their anguish. When we can sense the frailty of someone very elderly and feel their pain quivering in our own hearts. And what this path really teaches us is that those moments of falling away of that sense of separation should not be left to chance. But that we can, in our own lives, be really relentless in questioning separation, the beliefs that perpetuate separation. We can, actually, through meditation and questioning, really challenge this seemingly impenetrable sense of me and mine and what belongs to me. I think this longing for compassion, this longing for connectedness, somehow really needs to be very much translated into the way that we live. You know, some years ago, some of you might have been here then, after the attacks on the World Trade Center, we had a group here where people kind of gathered together, really, I think somehow to support each other in the sense of bewilderment, not only about what had happened, but about what might be yet to come. And it was really very lovely until someone came and really disagreed. Someone spoke up, not so much in the group, but really disagreed afterwards. And you could almost sense this kind of tension rising. You know, suddenly there was a them. There was a definite them. And it was so interesting how that I saw people respond to that, not immediately in this place of reactivity, of you're wrong, you know, you're not entitled to feel that way, but that sense of being able to listen and understanding how that belief too came from fear and from anxiety. Now, I always find it very interesting to look at the story of me. Do you ever find it interesting just to look at your story? The story of you. Huh? I always find it so interesting because what does it really rest on? You know, what are the building blocks of the story of me? Well, you know, my body is part of it, my appearance, my personal history, my opinions, my views. Doesn't it seem like a long story? I mean, actually, you know, it's so long that for most of us, my story began long before I was even born. You know, if you ever listened to yourself and heard your mother, you think, oh, no. You know, or you look in the mirror and you see your father looking back at you. And you see some of the tendencies you kind of act out in your life and you think, oh, these look very familiar. You know, and it seems like the story of me begins long before we were even born. Now, it's interesting about this story of me because it's not really fixed, is it? I mean, it can be fixed. But it's not really an eternal story. It's constantly being rewritten. Sometimes our story is rewritten by new experience. You know, I see this all of the time in teaching. Someone will come on a retreat and they'll have a very definite story of me. You know, I'm an agitated person, they'll say. And then guess what? A moment of calm. And it's like, oh, that story is not quite so solid. You know, a person comes and says, well, I'm really just an aversive type. And then they'll find themselves being very generous to someone. It's, oh, that story is being rewritten by new experience and by understanding. I think only when it's not examined does our story remain a closed book. It's a kind of finished manuscript. Then we see ourselves being imprisoned in our story. That sense of really being imprisoned. Now, sometimes when you look at the story of me, what you actually see is the story of me is really written by what is clung to or identified with. You know, if I identify with rage, I'm angry. You know, if I identify with greed, I'm greedy. You know, if I identify with fear, I'm fearful. So you can kind of begin to sense that moment to moment about how the story is being written by what is being clung to in the moment. Sometimes it's more general, you know, it's the clinging to my gender, my prejudices, my race, my opinions. Now, the story that is written by clinging, I think this is a story that fosters and solidifies this sense of a separate me, divided from others. Because how do we define others? Well, we define them by their history or their relationships or their appearance. Now, it's interesting that when our story is written by clinging, even if it is a totally miserable story, we actually don't often want our assumptions to be challenged. We'd actually rather stay in what is familiar often than to have our opinions overturned, because then there's that sense of, who would we be? You know, who would I be without this description, you know, this sense of identity based on what I cling to? You know, we could imagine sort of being this formless blob who just sort of is stuck on a meditation cushion for the rest of their lives, you know, dysfunctional in the world, you know. Who would I be without that identification? And I think that fear often keeps us clinging. But you can see that that not only works inwardly, but it also works inwardly. You know, just like we have the stories of other people. Now, we have sometimes an investment in keeping that going, don't we? I mean, if someone has hurt us or offended us, you know, in a way we want to solidify them as an enemy, don't we? And we make the long list of imperfections, everything that's wrong with them. In fact, they don't have one redeeming characteristic by the time we finish with them, with our story writing. But doesn't that also solidify that separation of you that becomes impenetrable? And the sad thing is that we can't see in that freezing the mutuality of our longing to be safe and protected, the mutuality of our longing to be respected and cared for, the mutuality of our longing to be understood. What does compassion mean in these moments when there feels to be so much solidity? I think it means a tremendous amount of courage, a tremendous amount of fearlessness, the willingness to cross the borders of our own hearts and minds, the willingness to cross beyond the borders that our story has created to. It means the willingness to cross beyond the borders of the countries created by clinging. Because otherwise we just are always in a position of striking out. Now, our story can be written by clinging, but our story can also be written by compassion. This is the other possibility. By our willingness to really understand and embrace the causes of suffering and to end them, including the suffering that is born within our own stories. Now, it's not to say that this path is about story negation. It's not that kind of nihilism, you know, that we're trying to negate ourselves. I mean, if you look around, look within, it's clear we all have a story in this life, and my story is different than yours. Your story is different than the person beside you. And our story is born of the conditions of our lives, of what we're not always in control. But we begin to see the story can never be the whole truth. One of my teachers, you may have heard me say this in the past, but it's something I love. He said to me, the thought of your mother is not your mother. Interesting. The thought of your mother is not your mother. We could translate and say that the thought of yourself is not yourself. The thought I have of another person cannot be the wholeness of that other person. Now, the story that we have, born of our lives, born of our experience, this is actually not any kind of obstacle to compassion. But we actually learn to embrace our story and its potentiality for causing sorrow or for evoking healing. And we learn within our story how to embrace all stories. This is the path of the Bodhisattva. Milarepa again once said, long accustomed to cultivating compassion, I can no longer think in terms of self or other. Now, again, I think it is really very important not to imagine that if we cultivate compassion, we never experience fear, we never experience anger, we never experience rage. But, of course, these feelings do arise. And we acknowledge that they are very often awakening feelings. Do we channel those feelings into harm or into understanding? Into perpetuating sorrow or relieving it? And I think this is the fearlessness of compassion. Knowing in our lives none of us can live in a bubble of disengagement. We are always going to be engaged, and we can only choose how. Now, compassion really asks for that engagement, but engagement comes in so many different forms. I think there are times in the face of suffering when we really need to know that sometimes all that can be offered in those moments are a receptive, listening presence. It was a woman I met who had been severely burned in a fire, and in the days in hospital after her accident, she said many, many people came to visit her, and she couldn't see for a time. And she said there would be those who would come to visit and be an outpouring of consolation and hope. You know, you'll get better soon. This will soon be over. There were others who would come and they were kind of like homemakers, you know. What can I do to fix it? You know, I'll take care of this. I'm going to feed your cat. You're going to do this. And she said all of these were very helpful. But she said there are also those who could just come and sit and hold her hand. And she said sometimes that was what was most important, that compassionate, receptive presence that can listen to the cries of the world. And I think that is a gift of fearlessness, because it is not easy to be present in the face of suffering and not be broken. But that is where that sense of the willow, that capacity to bend, to feel what is felt but not be broken, to be able to come back upright. But I think compassion too is also an invitation to know when we need to be fearless in our actions and speech and choices. Know when we need to say no to the causes of suffering. Know when we actually need to intervene. When we are called upon to protect the well-being of another or of ourselves. Sometimes that's as simple as moving a small creature out of the road, but sometimes it is much more radical than that. It's a poem I'd like to read you. It says, "The old man must have stopped our car 24 times to climb out and gather into his hands the small toads, blinded by our lights, and leaping like drops of rain. The rain was falling, a mist about his white hair. And I kept saying, 'You can't save them all. Accept it. Get back in. We've got places to go.' But leathery hands full of wet brown life, knee deep in the summer roadside grass, he just smiled and said, 'They have places to go to.'" I think just as compassion really doesn't measure the worth of any act or response that relieves suffering, neither does compassion measure the value or worth of suffering itself. I think for some people, at times because they have a long story or history of perhaps being unworthy or undeserving of attention, they make a hierarchy of suffering. You know, and I think there can be in that the tendency to look out at the world and see the immensity of torment that some people face on a daily basis. And then they can feel that it's sort of inappropriate or self-indulgent to extend compassion to themselves. They can feel, oh, you know, this struggle, this difficulty, it's meaningless, it's insignificant compared to that. And they can trivialize their own torment. But I think we understand that compassion really doesn't have any hierarchies or boundaries. And in many real ways, if we don't know how to be patient and steadfast and receptive and to tend to pain that we experience in our own bodies, our own minds, our own relationships, how can we possibly imagine that we will know how to tend to pain or struggle or distress in the body or life of another? In many ways, within ourselves, we learn how to listen to the cries of the world. We learn how to listen to the sounds of the universe. And I think that is the essence, because I think that we and the world we live in are probably most endangered by that reluctance to listen. To really listen to the cries, really listen to the sounds of the universe. And if we ignore pain, then I think our capacity for compassion and understanding and care instead gets channeled into fear. Compassion, like all the Brahmaviharas, has so many different textures within it. Sometimes it's about patience. Sometimes it's about generosity. Sometimes it's about perseverance. Sometimes it's about integrity. But I think, above all, it is about being able to listening. To listen. And again, a friend of mine, Stephen, who many of you know, he once put it that we cannot in this path attain awakening for ourselves, that we can only participate in the awakening of life. That we cannot attain awakening for ourselves, but that we can only participate in the awakening of life. And somehow I think it's very important to put everything that we do here and everything that we do in our own practice into that context, that our motivation is really to participate in the awakening of life. And part of that awakening of life, I think, is really nurturing moment to moment that capacity to listen to the cries of the world, inwardly, outwardly. Really makes no difference.